Welcome to the Mental Health Podcast, a series of interviews with figures in the world of psychology, asking them about their fields of interests, opinions, and published works.
I'd like to introduce Dr. Mark Williams, Professor of Clinical Psychology and Wellcome Principal Research Fellow at Oxford University. His research in clinical and experimental psychology focuses on understanding the psychological processes that underlie depression and suicidal behaviour and the development of new psychological treatments. He received the Shapiro Award from the British Psychological Society and has been elected Fellow of the Academy of Medical Sciences and Fellow of the British Academy. With Drs. Siegel and Teasdale, he authored Mindfulness-Based Cognitive Therapy for Depression, a best-selling book for professionals. Mindfulness-Based Cognitive Therapy was developed by Zindel Siegel, Mark Williams and John Teasdale, based on Jon Kabat-Zinn's Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Programme. The MBCT programme was designed specifically to help people who suffer repeated bouts of depression. The UK National Institute of Clinical Excellence has recently endorsed MBCT as an effective treatment for prevention of relapse. The Mindful Way Through Depression, published by Guildford Press and distributed throughout the UK and Europe by Taylor & Francis, is written for anyone who suffers from depression or chronic unhappiness and would like to find a way to improve their own lives through mindfulness. Information about ordering and details of free sample chapters are available at the end of this podcast. Thank you for coming in, Professor Williams. Your new book, The Mindful Way Through Depression, is centred around mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. Could you explain what you mean by this term?
Mindfulness-based cognitive therapy is an 8-week programme in which people learn the skills to stay well after they've been depressed. It brings together modern psychological treatments, such as cognitive therapy, with ancient meditation techniques that have been known for 2,500 years. And both of these techniques converge on the idea that when you get depressed, you become really entangled in your own sort of negative thinking. Mm. You think things like, I'm worthless, I'm stupid, I'm a failure, I'm no good, I'm not good enough. And in each case, that maintains the depression. Sometimes you bring up evidence from the past that supports that conclusion. Sometimes you just get into this habit and you can't escape from it. And all your attempts to try to escape seem to be of no avail. So you just get more and more trapped in your own thinking and, you know, giving things up, just avoiding going out, feeling very helpless and hopeless. And both of these techniques help you to begin to stand back from your thinking, to see your thoughts come and going like clouds in the sky, and to learn to relate differently towards them and towards yourself.
Could you tell us what prompted you to write the book?
Well, we'd done some research which showed that mindfulness-based cognitive therapy was very useful at helping people stay well. In fact, we'd found that it cuts the risk of a depression occurring again by about half. That was a remarkable finding in itself. And we produced a professional book, Mindfulness-Based Cognitive Therapy for Depression, for professionals to help them learn the skills to help their, you know, to help their patients. Mm. But then we realised that, of course, not everybody can live near somewhere where they can go to classes, to the 8 classes that we normally run for people, often evening classes or afternoon classes, where people go for the classes to learn the skills of mindfulness. And so we thought what we really needed to do was to allow people to do this for themselves. And the whole purpose of The Mindful Way Through Depression was to give people the chance to read the program for themselves. With a CD, they could practice the mindfulness practices for themselves to deal with their own depression if they couldn't get to a class.
Right, so which audience do you think the book will appeal to?
Well, the book was originally written for those who'd been depressed in the past and wanted to prevent depression happening again. But now we find that actually it seems to have a much wider audience because there are many, many people who, although they haven't been clinically depressed, feel that they're not as happy as they would like to be. In fact, the book has been written for anybody who struggles constantly with low mood, with the feeling that they're not good enough, feeling that happiness eludes them, that they don't feel ever as happy as they would like to be. And that, of course, means that many people feel like that from time to time, but some people, it's almost becomes a way of life for them. They just can't get back, or perhaps they never, ever felt happy. And right from the outset, this book says, look, if this is true of you, it may not be because there's anything wrong with you. It may be that your valiant efforts to struggle to get out of this actually might be digging you deeper and deeper into the hole. Mm. And by identifying the ways in which you're struggling and which bits of that struggling might actually be making things worse rather than better, then you can just deal more skillfully with that struggling and then see if it's possible to find a way out without that so much struggling.
So could you explain how mindfulness practice helps people?
Mindfulness practice is a whole range of practices, actually, which are based on ancient meditation techniques. For example, focusing, learning to focus on parts of the body, learning to focus on the breath, beginning to focus on little things that we might miss in our daily lives, like routine activities that we normally miss. And what they do between them is a number of things. First of all, they help to train people's attention. When we've got strong emotions and feelings around, you may find that your attention is very difficult to focus. Your attention is hijacked all the time by your worries, your concerns, memories from the past, regrets, worries about the future, needing to plan things, things that are going on in your life at the moment with family, with friends, with work. And it's very difficult to focus on one thing. Your attention doesn't seem to be like it's under your control at all. It's dispersed, it's scattered. And one of the first things that mindfulness does is to help people to focus their attention, to gather their attention. And we use various practices for that, most notably focusing on the breath. Mm. Focusing on the breath is very useful for that because you can see at an instant when your mind has wandered onto something else. And that's the second thing that meditation does. It helps people to see clearly when the mind is wandering. You don't have to be meditating for more than a few seconds to notice that your mind has wandered. It might wander onto trivial things like, what am I going to have for tea tonight? Or it might be important things like, in a friendship that's gone wrong. But the fact that it's wandered is very clear to you. And then the task that you're given is just to notice where it's gone, acknowledge that it's gone, and then gently escort your attention back to your breathing. And that may happen 1,000 times, and the task is always the same, just to bring your attention back to your breathing. And in that way, people begin to notice earlier when the mind is wandering. And the aim is not to try to clear the mind, because the mind won't be cleared, but to notice the mind wandering and to decide, do I want to follow this wandering mind, or do I want to come back to where I had intended my mind to be? The third thing that it helps people to do is to notice the warning signals that they're getting upset. Many of us don't notice it until it's too late, when we start to slam a door or when we end up shouting at somebody in the corridor or whatever. And there have often been warning signals, sometimes in our body. Sometimes our body is feeling tense or upset, or our shoulders are hunched or our face is frowning, but we don't notice that. The body is a wonderful source of information for people about how they're feeling, but mostly we ignore it or take it for granted. Mm. So people learn to notice the warning signs at an earlier stage when they might do something about it. And the fourth thing that mindfulness does is to put people back in touch with the sort of small beauties and pleasures of life that most of us have taken for granted because we're too busy to notice. We work on autopilot all the time and we lose touch with the things in life that used to give us pleasure, or maybe the people in life that we used to enjoy being with. And that often goes alongside unhappiness and depression, and this helps to get people back in touch with that.
So can people learn mindfulness if they've not been clinically depressed?
Yes, they can. And in fact, most people who learn mindfulness in various ways haven't been clinically depressed because, as I said, this book and other books written for people to learn mindfulness are for everybody. It's the sense that everybody discovers when they use these practices how much of their mind is on autopilot all the time, on automatic pilot. You might know that when you're driving down the motorway, you can drive for miles sometimes and suddenly wake up and think, oh my gosh, where have I been all this time? And it's not just driving the motorway, doing things that we often ignore, like washing the dishes, for example. washing the dishes, we may not attend to it because we're just getting on and finishing them off before we sit down and have a cup of tea, for example. So we don't notice ourselves doing the dishes. The question is, where is our mind when we're having the cup of tea we promised ourselves? Well, very often it's not on the tea, it's on what we're going to do next. So we look at the empty cup and we think, did I just drink that? Well, I suppose I must have done because there's nobody else around. So we've just missed the dishes, now we've missed our tea. Where are you next? You know, and we go through life just leaning into the next moment, planning, thinking about all the things we've got to do, and we miss the moment we're actually having now. And people eventually come to this amazing realization that maybe at the end of their lives, when they've got 6 months to live, they're going to look back on their life and think, like the empty cup, was that just my life I just lived? And that makes people think, ah, I wonder if there's a way I could own my life in a different sort of way, actually wake up a few more times a day to what's actually happening right now, rather than waiting till I'm on holiday, postponing things until I finish this project, until I've got over this, till we've got over Christmas, till we've got past my birthday, till I finish this project, till I finish this dissertation, till I finish this reading this book, then I'll be happy. So we always tend to postpone peace, postpone happiness until another day. Mm-hmm. And this practice challenges us to say, what about waking up to how things are now? And we may not have to do anything very different. We just have to notice, attend, wake up. And that's what this practice helps us do.
And how does this book differ to other self-help books?
It's difficult for me to comment on comparing this with other self-help books for obvious reasons, but people tell me that it's different in a number of different ways. I think one thing they notice is it doesn't tell us how we ought to behave or think or feel. It's not prescriptive. It's much more exploratory, of inviting the reader to say, well, how is this for you? Notice how this is for you. Don't take my word for it. Look at this. If you want to practice the meditations, there's a CD there for you to do it, so you don't just have to read it and take our word for it. You can actually experience this for yourself. And we've deliberately put the CD in with the book so that people can both read the book, but then they can practice it for themselves and see whether it's true for them. Mm-hmm. They really don't need to take our word for it. And I think that makes it different from a self-help book that says, here's the problem, here's the solution, do this and you'll feel wonderful. We know that this may not be what some people need, but we believe that for many people it may be transformative.
You mentioned in the book how mindfulness can help reduce the downward mood spirals. Can you expand further on this, please?
Well, mood is a funny thing. It's usually split into different sort of categories. So we think of emotions like anxiety, for example, or depression, sadness, or emotions of happiness, or emotions of disgust, and so on. If you think about how emotions evolved in us as a species, emotions evolved to be temporary. They have to be temporary because emotions signal to us that something's wrong very often, especially the negative ones. So anxiety is a very good example of that. Fear is important to help us prepare to fight or fly away from a predator, for example. If we see a lion, then fear is very useful. It helps us galvanize us for action. But when you think about nature, what happens in the natural world, it's very intriguing. If you see a lion, for example, chasing a herd of gazelle on the African savannah, they're terribly, terribly afraid. They run. And they need to run to escape the lion or the leopard or whatever. But notice what happens if it's the lucky day for the lion, actually it captures a gazelle and drags it off. What do the rest of the herd do? The astonishing thing is they go back to eating. They go back to grazing. They've got to graze to live. Their anxiety has been switched off as suddenly as it was switched on. And it's got to be switched off because if they remain anxious, if they remain fearful, then they wouldn't be able to, as it were, notice the signal of anxiety or fear the next day or 3 days' time when there's another animal chasing them. They wouldn't notice the difference between now is the time to graze and now is the time to run. Mm. So emotions evolved to be temporary. they have this signal function. But in humans, they don't switch off very often. In many of us, they do, but in many of us, they don't. And it's as if we're constantly running. Why? Because we humans have language. We can go to the past, we can go to the future, we can think through things. We can, as it were, build an image in our mind of, as it were, imaginary lions. And so instead of there being just the reality of what we have to be fearful or depressed about, there's all that what we create in our minds of the past. We can revisit regrets, embarrassments, things we're ashamed of in the past. We can think to the future of all the worrying things, all the things that might go wrong in the future. And it is, as it were, our minds are creating the things that the brain has evolved to run away from or to be depressed about. But the mind is, as it were, creating these images in the head. And so we keep running. We don't, as it were, start grazing again. Now, what does that actually mean for people who've been depressed in the past? What it means is that every time they get sad, in addition to the sadness, which is bad enough, as it were, then they start creating, or the mind starts creating, attempts to try to solve the sadness. Like, well, you better watch out, this is another depression coming up. And if it's another depression, you're going to be really hopeless and nobody will want to know you. There's no point going out. Therefore, you may as well stay in your room. And, well, you always knew you were a bit of a failure. You always knew you weren't really good enough. Notice how the mind is creating something out of the sadness. The sadness may have just been a temporary emotion, because that's what it's evolved to be. But what the mind creates is not just sadness, but sadness plus useless, worthless, failure, no good, no point in living. You're just a burden to everybody. Now what happens? You're completely entangled in all the stuff that's been created. And of course, when you don't like that, you try to push it away. And we alternate between suppression, which doesn't work, and entanglement and rumination and brooding, which also doesn't work. But the mind thinks, look, I'm doing the best I can. I'm trying to suppress. I'm trying to work it out. And although the mind is doing the best it can, it's actually digging us deeper and deeper into the hole from which we desperately want to escape. And that's what the downward mood spirals are all about. It's beginning to notice, and what mindfulness is good for, is to notice the join, actually notice that little gap that occurs between sadness, the pure feeling of sadness, which, and the unpleasantness of that, and the way in which the mind then elaborates it, broods about it. If you notice the gap, you then have more choice, bringing awareness to that gap and allowing the sadness to be as it is without elaborating it or trying to avoid it. And that then cuts out all the stuff that we make that's extra to what we actually need right now. We can let ourselves go from that.
The book includes a CD of guided meditations by Jon Kabat-Zinn. Could you tell us how each complements the other and how really to make the best use of this book?
Well, we invite people to experiment with the book, to use it not just as an ordinary book, but as something they can dip into. Some people may read the whole book right through and then dip into the meditations. Other people might dip into parts of the book and then decide, okay, I feel like I'd like to commit myself to the whole 8-week program. And we've put in the final chapter of the book, if people want to do the whole 8-week program, then we've put a sort of a guide for how to do it. Week 1, week 2, week 3. Just guiding people through which bits of the book to read and then which bits of the meditation tape. So we put in the final chapter of the book a sort of a map that people can use to guide them through which meditations to use which week and also which bits of the book to read that might help them to understand the aims and intentions of the meditations they're using. So we just invite people to explore. It's their book, it's their meditation. It's only they that can do the practice. Nobody else can do it for them. It's time, as it were, for them to say, how much am I committed to really nourishing myself and to use the practices as opportunities to take a little time each day to be with yourself and by yourself and tell anybody else who you share your life with of what you're doing so they won't interrupt or they can handle the phone, they can handle any callers to the door. And then you can go away by yourself, practice the meditations and just use that as an opportunity to nourish yourself sort of moment by moment and day by day.
And finally, do you believe that MBCT works?
Well, fortunately, we've got evidence that it does. Not only now the evidence which motivated us to write this book, but the research has moved on since the research that motivated this book. So, for example, there's research now showing that it can be useful in anxiety and worry. There's research that shows it can be useful in chronic fatigue syndrome, and research that it can be useful for people who are still feeling depressed and a bit even a bit suicidal. So people need to feel that they can explore this, that it may not be the total answer to everything, but that it might be a very useful complement to the other things they're doing. For example, they may want to use it alongside things like antidepressant drugs or the medication that they've been prescribed. There's no reason why you shouldn't use it alongside the medication. And there are websites people can go to if they want to learn a little more about this. And if they want to learn more about mindfulness, sometimes it's called insight meditation as well as mindfulness meditation. So people can find their own path through it. But the evidence base is growing all the time, and people should feel that they can explore it and to give it, I think, the best chance. Often we say to people who start the 8 week, who come to us for classes, often we say to them, well, suspend judgment until you've had a few weeks at this. Because often meditating every day or 6 days out of seven is really hard work, and it doesn't seem to be getting very much benefit. You know, when you start learning a language, you seem to be getting absolutely nowhere. It seems to just getting your tongue tied and this sort of thing. But just a little bit of practice each day, and after a few weeks, it starts becoming fluent. And so I encourage people to start with an open mind, knowing that people have found this very useful. But those people who found it most useful, when we've asked them to give advice to people starting out, and we say, well, what advice would you give to people starting out? They always say, just stick at it, even if you don't enjoy it. Just stick at it. And then after 7 or 8 weeks, then you can judge whether it's been helpful for you.
Well, thank you for joining us today, Professor Williams. For more information about The Mindful Way Through Depression, please visit www.guildfordpress.co.uk, where a sample chapter can be downloaded and the full book can be ordered. You can listen to and subscribe to more podcast interviews at this same address.